Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we will be talking with Dr. Jennifer Leaning, Professor of the Practice of Health and Human Rights and Director of the Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University, about natural disasters, armed conflict, and your health.
Yeah, this is not a light subject, Christy, that we're going to be talking about today. But Jennifer Leaning,
Dr.
Leaning.
Expert.
Yeah, she's the real thing and has been around the world, and she had an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm really looking forward to hearing that. But first, Christy, we have some really interesting research that matters about things that aren't light either. We have things about weightlifting and diabetes.
And about dance as a treatment for urinary incontinence.
About, does it matter if you're working or studying or doing things in bright lights or dim lights?
And then something about teenage and adolescent boys who are afraid of being too skinny, and a relationship between depression and steroid use.
Some things that are heavier and lighter, but hopefully important to your health. Let's jump right into the very first research that matters, Christy. And this was an article about weightlifting and diabetes published in the open access journal called PLOS Medicine.
Well, this is exciting news for me since I am doing weightlifting through CrossFit and enjoying that. This research really looks at 100,000 U.S. nurses over a period of 8 years and discovered that women who pump iron or do some weightlifting in the gym have a lower risk of developing diabetes over that time, even above the basics of eating a healthy, balanced diet and keeping a normal weight.
Yeah, those who had regular aerobic activity 2.5 hours a week and also 1 hour a week of muscle strengthening cut their risk of developing diabetes by a third. And this idea that weightlifting could add to the benefits of aerobic activity, bicycling, running, jumping, swimming, was actually very interesting. It's not one I appreciated, but it is something that sounds like it's important. And so, you know, we shouldn't poo-poo weightlifting at all. Matter of fact, I heard you were weightlifting yourself recently.
Yeah, I just did a CrossFit competition that was really hardcore.
Along with one of our other colleagues, Dr. Donahue.
Yep.
And you guys came in 30th overall, I heard.
We sure did, and we were among the oldest people in the room, so we were feeling pretty proud of ourselves.
You were doing weightlifting and some aerobic, probably.
Yeah, it's a combination through CrossFit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you cut your risk of diabetes in addition to making us all proud of you, Christy.
That is great news. Thank you, Adam, for being proud. Well, let's talk next about dance, another physical activity, as a potential treatment for urinary incontinence in elderly women.
This was a really interesting article that was in this journal called Neurourology and Urodynamics. That's a hard journal to say, but it's an
important hard to say.
Journal because people needing to be able to control their bladder and having urinary incontinence when they can't is really important. And they have a treatment that they think can help.
So we know that there are certain exercises that women can do that will help strengthen their bladder muscles. But this was a study where the researchers added a series of dance exercises through a video game console to the normal physical therapy program that was targeting those pelvic floor muscles. What they found, Adam?
Well, they did what's called an effectiveness study or kind of a practical study. In other words, can they get these women to do these exercises? And so that's called a feasibility study. And the things that you really want to find out is, like, if you set it up, will they do it before they can try it in what's called a randomized controlled trial? And what they found is that the women were much more likely to want to do these exercises if they made it fun and through a video game where people could come and dance and have fun and play a game.
And, yeah, they found that they had fewer dropouts and a higher participation rate, so this increase in compliance. But they also found a higher decrease in the amount of urine leakage than the women who were in the usual program looking at effectiveness. So, I mean, it looks
promising. This research is ready for primetime testing.
And it might be more fun, so you do it more, and then it works.
I love the idea of dancing and weightlifting, improving diabetes risk, and improving your health and less incontinence, which talk about this next research thing, because maybe we can find out, should we have bright lights or dim lights when we have this?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is interesting research from the Journal of Consumer Physiology, really looking at this relationship between bright lights and mood, as well as emotional responses.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of Consumer Psychology, and this was a hard article for me, Christy, and part of it was because they were looking at some things that maybe I don't normally do, like choosing between chicken wing sauces that were mild or hot, or how aggressive a fictional person was, one that I may or may not do very often, I wouldn't admit it, but whether or not three women were attractive or not, and then finally, their feelings about certain words, were they positive, negative, or neutral? So these are some things that are kind of artificial situations, but they wanted to see, did the bright lights make a difference in how you process or thought about these issues?
Right, and they compared that to people who were in like just a computer-lit room, so more dim conditions. And in the brighter room, they found that the participants wanted spicier chicken wing sauce, and they thought that fictional character was more aggressive. They found women more attractive. They felt better about positive words and worse about negative words, drank more of certain juices than others. And basically, their conclusions are that under bright lights, like what you have in high school and what you have a lot of times at work, those fluorescent lights, that somehow is linked to more intense feelings.
Right. So if you want to maybe tone down the intensity, you could tone down the lights. And at times, that's probably the right thing to do. You don't really necessarily, if you're feeling kind of agitated, you may not want to have those bright lights up there.
Yeah, I think this certainly needs more study before we can draw great conclusions from it. But I think that if you enjoy having your office lit by more dimly lit, then that is perfectly appropriate, and you can defend it with this research.
Well, very quickly, our last research that matters is about weight and teenage boys and adolescent boys, and that those who think they're too skinny, even if they're not skinny, are at much higher risk for depression and taking steroids and being bullied. I think that's profound.
It is. This was research published in the American Physiological Association's Journal of Psychology of Men and Masculinity, and really saw that there was, for boys who inaccurately see themselves as overweight, we're more likely to be depressed to those who think they're at average weight. And there was also a link to bullying and to use of steroids and feeling more depressed than other boys their age. So this is something that we really need to draw attention to.
Well, it is. Well, Christy, we've had a good chance to talk about this issue of underweight in adolescent males, someone we don't talk too much about.
About for a calmer office, maybe dim the lights.
About dancing and even weightlifting. And Christy, I got a little special treat for us on the way out to a break here. I couldn't help but think when you were talking about Dim the Lights about Donna Summer and one of her songs. So we're going to listen to something a little unusual, a little song here as we go and take a break.
Oh, Adam, everybody's in for a treat. That's Donna Summer.
Donna Summer, Dim All the Lights.
All right. Well, that concludes the time that we have for Research That Matters. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Jennifer Leaning about disasters, armed conflict, and your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jennifer Leaning, professor of the Practice of Health and Human Rights and director of the Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University, about a recent article she wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine on natural disasters, armed conflict, and public health. And we're going to be talking about your health.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Leaning.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
So you are the co-founder of Physicians for Human Rights and Physicians for Social Responsibility. But share with us and for our listeners to give us a context of how you pursued this avenue and became an expert in this field.
Well, I'm an emergency physician, actually trained in internal medicine, and then worked in emergency medicine and got grandfathered in. So I'm board certified in both specialties. But as an emergency physician, you really worry about disasters. And so I began to study disasters as well as interact with small-scale ones. From that, moved into concern for quite large-scale disasters. Nuclear war as a potential was probably off the charts in scale, but that was one of the reasons that drew me to PSR. And so I was in the leadership in the early days after Three Mile Island in the 1979-1980s. And then as I began working increasingly in crisis areas as a human rights investigator for Physicians for Human Rights, I began to look at the humanitarian community more broadly, not just the domestic disaster responders, but the international cadre of people who work in wars and very major disasters. And so it was my study of public health operations and norms in both war and disaster that led me to become a teacher here at Harvard and to speak from my experiences and to write about them as well.
And well, Dr. Leaning, when you mentioned PSR, for our listeners, that's the Physicians for Social Responsibility that you and a lot of the leaders there, and I even had the chance to work with this here in North Carolina, but shared in the Nobel Peace Prize at one time for the work that the domestic and the international group had done. Tell us, though, how broad, in your article in the New England Journal of Medicine, you lay out some statistics that are really overwhelming in some respects, humbling in many, about this dimensions between the public health interventions and the humanitarian crises that are occurring around the world each year with natural disasters and armed conflict. Get us a sense of this.
Well, I wrote this article with a very good colleague, Debbie Guha-Sapir, who runs the Center for the Research in the Epidemiology of Disasters, CRED is the acronym, at the University of Louvain in Brussels. And she has a center with a number of crackerjack statisticians, and by now a reputation whereby everybody reports everything possible to her ship. And she's also in close ties with the U.S. government for linkage in terms of reporting and analytic mechanisms. So she has a record. Well, they're very complex sets of records, but the one that is most striking from the standpoint of people involved in war and disaster is the extent to which natural disasters has increased markedly over this century, and the real inflection point is in the late 1970s, and then another inflection point comes around 1998-2000. So we began 1950 with about 25 to 50 disasters every year, and now going into 2012, 2013, and 14, we are averaging 300 or 350 major natural disasters every year. And the great majority of this increase in number of disasters, the great majority of these disasters are climate change related. That is, they are wind and water storms, which are the ones that will be most affected by climate change. And so that is one point to emphasize when we think about natural disasters now and their interactions with the environment. And the other big point to take from the data that she has analyzed and a number of us have looked at very carefully is that the number of people killed from these disasters has remained relatively constant over the last 50 years. Gone up a bit because we've had some mega disasters and there's greater population living in hazardous areas or high-risk areas. But it says something quite important about the impact of disaster management on the part of the civil authorities, response on the part of both military and civil actors, and the public health response in emergency medicine and trauma response, that we've been able to salvage people in the context of this marked rise in the number of disasters.
And so you're saying we've had a marked rise in the number of disasters. We've gotten better, perhaps, at taking care of people through that. And so the constant number of loss of life and effect in those numbers is about the same?
Yeah, exactly. And so that is, I think that's sort of an amazing relationship.
Mm-hmm. And when you also talk about armed conflict, and in comparing national disasters to armed conflict and to, you know, awful things that happen to people in both situations, you know, how do you think about which of these categories puts the world's people in the greatest jeopardy, and how does location and geography play a part in that?
That's a great question. Disasters tend to occur suddenly, and in some ways, recovery is shorter when one compares them to wars and conflict. In general, wars and armed conflict create a much greater population of people who are fleeing. We call them forced migrants. And they wind up in categories of either refugees, they've had to cross an international border to escape from the harms of the conflict, or they are internally displaced, IDPs. Similar reasons for flight, but they have not been able to reach or cross a border, so they're displaced within their own country. Hmm. And the length of stay that millions of people now in refugee or IDP status must endure is very, very long. It's getting, for those who have been refugees or IDPs for several years, it's getting to be a prospect where they are likely to face, based on the numbers that we're following over the last 30 years, they're likely to face another 15 or 20 years of being in refugee or IDP status.
When we think,
the issue here is that the human consequences of war and conflict are more intense, more violent, and more protracted than the human consequences of most natural disasters.
So when we think about, for instance, what's happening in Syria today, and we hear about the number of people killed, is the number of people at risk or sick and ill and potentially to die from the mass migration and the diseases that occur, is that the area that we sometimes don't focus on?
Yes, thank you. That is the area we often don't focus on, and it's one of the reasons we were really glad that the New England Journal of Medicine was interested in this article, because for physicians and public health practitioners, it's very important to recognize that the great majority of deaths in war and conflict are borne by civilian populations. And yes, many are caught up in the actual sharp edges of the war and die from traumatic wounds or injuries, but most of them, it's now getting up to 85 to 90% of those civilians who die are dying from the destabilization that war introduces.
Well, Dr. Leaney, we are going to need to take a short break. But when we come back, I hope that we'll be able to touch on, you know, with all of this that you've learned, how our humanitarian efforts and our emergency relief should differ in thinking about natural disasters and armed conflicts. We're going to take this break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with our guest, Dr. Jennifer Leaney, professor of the practice of health and human rights at Harvard University, about natural disasters, armed conflict, and your health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Christy and I have been talking with Dr. Jennifer Leaney, professor of the practice of health and human rights and director of the Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University, about natural disasters, armed conflict, and your health. And Dr. Leaney, I know that you don't just talk the talk, you walk the walk. You've been to so many places around the world. Tell us a little bit about your own experiences providing care and the things that you've witnessed in armed conflict and natural disasters.
Most of my experience has been in human rights investigations where I have been working alongside humanitarian relief and medical providers. And so I have a perspective on some of the issues they face, as well as a perspective on the context in which they're trying to work.
Give us one, an example,
one,
yeah.
Yeah, one of the most vivid experiences I had was actually quite a while ago. It was in the end of 1991, early 1992, in the conflict in Somalia. Somalia has been at war in and out since that period, which started the sort of disintegration of government and the warring clans who created havoc and disorder for civilians and civil society ever since. And in that time, I was there observing the medical response to the attacks on the city of Mogadishu. There were several clans that were fighting, and they were pulverizing this beautiful old city that was made of sandstone and concrete, had a tremendous reputation as being a garden city on the Indian Ocean. The Italians had had a major influence over it. They were pulverizing this essentially soft-shell city with artillery barrages that were coming from what were called technicals, these machine guns that were landed, that were fixed to jeeps, and just prowling around the roads and getting to a city block and then blasting it to smithereens. And in the few hospitals that the humanitarian community was manning, there were casualties being brought in by wheelbarrow by backs of civilians. And they these were very messy casualties, traumatic wounds with fractures and sand and dust and pieces of rebar stuck in them. I mean, just horrifying injuries. Mm. And the hospitals were not set up for this. They didn't even have an emergency department. And the volunteer doctors were working in really tough conditions, often no electricity, very little light, even when there was light, and a very, very austere set of medical supplies and operative options, actually. And what struck me were two things. One is the stoicism of the Somali patients who were coming in and had to wait a long time, or who had to endure a tremendous amount of pain, even though there was ketamine and morphine. There's, you know, emergency departments that I'm aware of, when there's been a traumatic disaster, they have a lot of noise in them. These areas were quiet, except for the ongoing artillery bombardments outside. And that was actually something that made me realize we're dealing with people who have suffered a great deal and whose culture is actually, and I inquired about it, built on stoicism. That this is how you live. You don't show pain. And the other aspect of this that I noticed, and it impressed the doctors and nurses, both the expat and the local ones, and the other thing I noticed was this city was under siege and it was famine conditions. So it was impossible to find food in the markets. And if you did have food, you had to eat in a secret place with the windows drawn because of likely attack. So the major issue for the post-op patients was could their family come in and provide them with food. And the mantra among the doctors and nurses is, if you don't have a family, you die here, because there was not enough food to feed anybody. And the doctors were very, very hungry, and they relied, the local doctors relied on the international community, the Red Cross, flying in an airplane every day into the airport of Mogadishu, which is pretty dangerous, coming in and bringing in medical supplies like tetanus, and also food for the medical staff at the major hospitals.
Well, that story really brings up, the thinking about the value of the local health care and the societal and cultural norms within a country, and potential conflict that could come in if emergency aid and international aid is coming in either not understanding or unfamiliar to cultural norms, or potentially undermining that local community and infrastructure. How do you teach people, advise people? What are your thoughts about how to overcome that potential conflict?
Well, Christy, that's really a great question. I had to keep my jaw clenched during much of my time there because I saw a lot of things in terms of medical practice and surgical practice that should not have been done by the very inexperienced local staff and also by some of the expat doctors. And there were failures to maintain just antisepsis control in the OR, for instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, I won't go through the number of things. But what it did tell me was that there was a need for the humanitarian practitioners and people in public health school. There was a great need for them to learn what some of the issues were so that they had a better context in which to put their experiences when they went overseas, and they were prepared to do some things right and avoid doing some things that were clinically or ethically unacceptable. So it fueled my passion to understand these issues more deeply and then to be a very good teacher in sort of a preventive medicine mode and harden but also improve the mindset of mm-hmm. the people who wanted to go out and be humanitarian relief workers. It's not easy, it's exacting, it's physically demanding, and it is morally deeply challenging.
You know, you mentioned the word prevention, and I know your work from previous lives, you value that as much as anything in what you do. And in this particular area in which you have 200 million that are already affected by natural disasters a year and 300 million living in insecurity around the world and threat of wars, help us understand where you think we're going in terms of prevention efforts. Because it's clear, just like you champion preventing nuclear war as the only way to effectively deal with that potential disaster, it seems like that's where the future is here. What do we know, and what role do physicians have in this?
Well, in terms of natural disasters and climate change, I think physicians around the world and healthcare professionals in general need to get educated about the impact of climate change on populations and the high-risk populations living in coastal areas, deltas, river valleys are among the most to be studied. But that means there is a tremendous amount of preventive work to be doing about our developed society lifestyles and carbon footprint. That is not a distant issue. We're talking about changes in the environment that could spell over the next 10 or 15 years more storms along the East Coast like Hurricane Sandy and great tornadoes and cyclones like the one that hit the Philippines recently. Because the air is warming, the water is warming, the currents are changing, the storms are becoming much more powerful and the sea surge is becoming much greater. So this is, the disasters are upon us, and we need to have people working on the primary prevention mode, which is to deal with the impacts of climate change. The other, about wars, and the other point about these disasters is we need to have the international community, which includes public health experts and physicians, be more attentive to what the coping strategies are of local populations. Many cannot move. They're trapped by their own lifestyles and livelihoods and poverty and failed government policies. They cannot move out of the way. So what are the adaptive strategies these populations can make in advance of these storms? One is better warning so that they can seek shelter. The other is better vaccination so that when they are isolated, they're not dealing with resurgence of measles in the short run when they're on their own. There are many, many strategies to think about and many, many roles for doctors. And that includes in the United States because the coastal U.S. is going to be one of the most affected by climate change in terms of wind and water storms. In terms of war and disaster, I think primary prevention is absolutely essential. Once these wars start going, and they're internal wars, they're very nasty, they have huge issues as they go on with cruelty and brutality, which then evokes vengeance and revenge and bitterness. These wars can go on for years, and it's partly because there's not, at a certain point, not a great political agenda, and you don't have somebody to talk to. They become part of a criminalized disorder. I mean, look at the length of time it's taken to get warring parties together in eastern DRC, and that's, it's a very fragile place right now. So that the suffering that comes when these wars begin to unravel is immense, and the international community, as much as we honor and value the humanitarian responders who go in, the international community actually can only apply some Band-Aids at these points. The great bulk of people, you know, don't see a humanitarian worker, and they are trying to survive on their own in the forest or in the desert. So from my perspective, it is really important for organizations like the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and UNHCR, the big humanitarian agencies, to be very, very powerful in their demand that the underlying issues of economics and ethnic conflict and real asymmetries in power within a country, that these issues get addressed. Now, for physicians and nurses who have a family practice here in the United States, part of this is just a matter of getting educated, writing letters to the editor, and for in terms of these wars.
Well, is there a great, is there a good website or resource for our listeners who want to get more involved, want to understand the issues, and be more vocal as advocates for people around the world?
Well, I would say the CDC is a great website for looking at some of these issues around climate change and new disaster risks. The other is there's the National Hazards website at Boulder, Colorado, which is a magnificent disaster website. And it is all over climate change, and they have tremendous stories and data.
Wonderful.
And maybe we can also put the link to your colleague's work overseas.
That's right. And so I could send you that link.
Great.
I don't have it right in front of me,
it's
but
okay.
The link to these colleagues would be very, very interesting for people.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Leaning, for being with us today, for the great work you're doing for people around the world, and for sharing that today with our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, though, Christy and I will be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Please stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And you can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu, and Christy and I will talk about them on an upcoming show. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call today about RSV.
My one-year-old child went to the hospital recently with a bad cough that he had for 3 days. The doctor said he likely had RSV virus. How do you know this, and how do you know it wasn't an asthma attack or the flu?
Well, that's I'm sorry that you had to face that with a one-year-old, because RSV can be a really mean virus.
Well, I know it wasn't asthma or the flu because the doctor said it wasn't. The doctor is always right, isn't
it?
Well,
it's a complicated question. Asthma can be wheezing related or reactive airways related to a virus. So there can be asthma with a virus at the same time. RSV and the flu, there are certain characteristics that we look at that are typical of each one, but also now there are pretty fast tests that we can do of the secretions in the baby's nose and tell you whether it's the flu or whether it's RSV.
Yeah, and the doctor may have done a swab at the same time to test for both, may not have told you that
exactly.
They checked for the flu and that it was negative in the RSV. But, you know, it's the right age group, one-year-old. It sounds like a bad cough. You didn't say fever and headache. Child could still have a fever with RSV, but it is important to make the right diagnosis here because the treatments may differ a little bit, and particularly that RSV can be very, very serious if not treated appropriately.
Right, and the flu, if you catch it within the first couple of days of getting symptoms, then there are medicines that can often be beneficial. So if you are having those symptoms, hopefully he's better now, but we're sorry that you went through that. And certainly if you're worried about RSV or the flu, you should go to your doctor and talk to him about it.
Yeah, usually RSV gets worse around day three, and days four and five can be tough. So please do talk with your doctor. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I'm 40 years old, and I was recently told that I have gout. My doctor said I shouldn't eat meat or fish, and I was put on an anti-inflammatory medication. Do I really need to make lifelong changes in my diet? It's pretty difficult.
Oh, it is hard. And my patients with gout ask me this question often, because some of the things on the list of things to avoid are things like beer and alcohol and things that people, you know, might not want to give up entirely. And we can't say 100% if you eat, if you have one beer, or in this case, if you, you know, eat fish at all, that that will cause you to get another flare-up of your gout. But we can say that these things make it more likely for you to have gout flares. So you have to sort of weigh out with each thing on that list. And we can ask our fantastic health sciences librarians to post that list of foods to avoid that can trigger gout. But you have to kind of weigh out, well, how bad was that gout flare? And is it worth it for me to try this little bit of whatever it is?
Yeah, it used to be that we used to, a lot of times, put people on pretty stringent diets. But now a lot of our newer diet recommendations are really healthy eating diets. They're not necessarily specifically gout prevention diets. We certainly want to try to reduce the uric acid in your bloodstream frequently. And that comes from these chemicals, these amino acids called purines. And certain foods such as organ meats, veal, and those really dark meats, anchovies, asparagus, mushrooms, are high in these purines. So sometimes they'll give these diets to help, you know, decrease that. But we also have some medications that are really effective at doing this as well. So I think you could talk with your doctor, you could see a nutritionist, good healthy eating, and also consider if you need medications.
That's a great response, Adam. Let's take our very next house call question about blood pressure. Erica?
I've had high blood pressure for 20 years, and in the last 3 days, it seems to have shot up dangerously high, 160 over 110. I felt dizzy and my heart rate seemed high. Will this go away, or is it something, you know, more of an emergency? I don't feel stressed and otherwise healthy.
Well, we're glad that you're healthy in general, except for your blood pressure, and we're glad that you don't feel stress, which also means we can't blame stress for your high blood pressure.
Right. And, you know, with the blood pressure like that, you really should go to your doctor and bring in the values that you've gotten on the outpatient. And if you're feeling dizzy and your heart rate is up, then you need to go and talk to a medical provider about all of these factors, get your blood pressure checked in the office, and try to figure out what's been going on to contribute to it. And, you know, at that level, you would need to be on medicine to try to prevent any damage to your arteries or heart.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I have a rule, Christy, that when things don't seem right, they usually aren't. This time it doesn't seem right.
Mm-hmm. Especially not just 3 days worth.
Yep, something seems wrong here. We encourage you to go get checked out, get a good heart exam, get your blood pressure, review your medications, see what's going on. That's a good question. Let us know how you're doing. Erica, what's our very last house call?
I've had bacterial vaginosis at least 5 times in the last few years. I've used both antibiotic creams and pills, but it doesn't prevent it from coming back. Is there anything else I can do?
No, that's so tough, and I'm sorry that this is what this listener is asking about, is BV, or bacterial vaginosis, which is where women have normal bacteria, but sometimes there can be an overgrowth of bacteria and cause discharge and other problems. It can be treated. Very rarely, it is sexually transmitted in very rare cases. So that could be a possibility to get your partner checked and treated.
The other final possibility is sometimes when people get lots of these episodes, they will take suppressive therapy that they can take twice a week. You need to talk with your doctor about that and see whether or not it's indicated for you, because some people, some small number, will get them a lot. Well, that'll conclude the house calls today. But, Chris, we've had a really good chance not only to talk about this bacterial vaginosis,
but about high blood pressure,
and about RSV,
and a little bit about gout.
And then the gout, really cut back on the fat, limit or avoid the alcohol, limit foods with high fructose corn syrup, and limit meat and poultry. A good heart healthy diet.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today for your help. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. We want you to write us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Jennifer Leaning. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.